I thank you. This is Judge Larkin. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this morning. The next case on the court's calendar is Walker v. Walker. We're doing the hearing by Zoom. I don't know if either of the attorneys has participated in a Zoom hearing before. Our rules of procedure are the same as they would be if we were at the courthouse. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. Appellant's attorney will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. At this point, I would ask attorney for appellant to introduce himself for the record and begin argument. We'll give you a good 2 or 3 minutes to kind of lay out the issues you'd like to address this morning. Keep in mind that we're familiar with the facts of the case, and if we have questions about the facts, we'll ask. Given the limited time, we'd ask you to focus on your legal arguments to the extent possible. With that, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Ken Schuler. I'm an attorney in Rochester, and I was one of the trial attorneys for this case. We seek reversal of the court's decision determining that there was an enforceable contract to convey the 80 acres of land, and we seek a new trial with respect to Eric Walker's claim for uncompensated work that he did at the farm. The context is critical, and I'm not going back through the facts, but fundamentally what happened is Lynn Walker was tired of being abused by both her husband and her son in 2017. She sought a divorce. Her husband realized that through the divorce process, all the land, all their joint assets would be included in the marital estate. The husband, Steve Walker, has been working with Eric Walker to diminish the assets in the marital estate. And part of that plan was to have this lawsuit to initially try to take the entire farm and claim it belonged to Eric. And luckily, that claim was dismissed with a motion for partial summary judgment. But then at least to go after the 80 acres and then also to pursue this money damage claim. And it appears to be a plan that so far has been successful, and we're seeking to reverse that and to allow Lynn Walker to keep the money that she's worked so hard over the years to have. And if this goes forward, this is economically devastating for her. With respect to the first issue on appeal, the standard of review is de novo, subject to the court reviewing the evidence based on the same standard that the district court applied.
Counsel,
yes.
With regard to the standard of review, would you agree that this court must affirm the jury's verdict if it can be sustained on any reasonable theory of the evidence, and that we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict?
I agree with that.
And then given that there was testimony from both the father and the son as to this agreement, specifically that 80 acres would be transferred to Eric in forgiveness of the outstanding debt. Why isn't the evidence sufficient to sustain the district court's determination and the jury's verdict?
You'd need to have all three. Yeah, you'd have to have both fee owners of the property, both Lynn Walker and Steve Walker, agree. And the evidence of that, according to the Christie case, would have to be consistent and not contradictory, clear and not equivocal, convincing and not doubtful. And according to the Radke case, the facts must be tantamount to Lynn Walker admitting she made the contract in order to meet the very high standard that has to be met as a matter of law for someone to claim an oral contract to convey.
Didn't both the father and son testify that Lynn was part of the meeting and agreement with regard to the contract for the 80 acres?
That's true, but look at the context of what's going on here. You'll notice I don't think Steve Walker is going to argue today. He didn't appeal this, and he got hammered with this judgment as well as Lynn Walker did. He wants to lose the case because he's conspiring with his son to get the land to his son and keep his wife from getting any part of the land through the divorce. So the fact that those two are coming to court and claiming that there was some sort of agreement is part of a conspiracy. And I'm not just making it up. There are overwhelming facts supporting that.
The jury rejected that perspective And in looking at whether the jury's verdict can be set aside, we're supposed to affirm the verdict if it can be sustained on any reasonable theory. So you have one theory, but isn't another theory that the evidence shows that the son worked for a number of years with an agreement that he would be paid, and then when he wasn't paid, that he was given 80 acres to compensate him for his work and that outstanding debt?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with your assertion of what the JMOL standard is here. And I'm not trying to be contradictory, but I'm looking at the standard and all the evidence, including that favoring the verdict, must be taken into account. The evidence is to be viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, and the court may not weigh the evidence or judge the credibility of the witnesses. I believe that's the standard that's applied. And we're saying...
I believe that's correct.
Okay. And so based on that standard, based on the evidence that we have in this case, and based on the fact that there is not clear and unequivocal evidence of any agreement with Lynn Walker, plus the fact that there's every incentive for the father and son to conspire with each other to try to ace out Mrs. Walker from her portion of the marital estate. And there's clear evidence that that's been going on. Once you get past that, and that this pall that hangs over the case as to what's really going on here, then you get into the evidence about whether or not there actually is an offer, whether there is acceptance, whether there's consideration for it. And we've gone through our brief in detail and explained how that is, it's contradictory, both with respect to offer and acceptance. And I won't spend the time going through all the evidence on that. You have that before you. I'm happy to discuss it if you like. But the most critical part of the trial from our perspective was the admission of Exhibit 3 and then Exhibit 4 into the case, which, I'll get a chance to discuss that hopefully here in a moment. But when that came into evidence and gave some, at least opportunity for the other side to claim that there was some actual agreement and that there was some money that was owed here, that was a critical part of the case. And it turned a 10-day jury trial into really a 10-day popularity contest, which we lost. And there was really no restriction as far as the rules of evidence with respect to any material evidence in the case. But there was no offer that, and we've studied all the case law on this all of the contradictory evidence as to when it was offered, when it wasn't offered, the leading that occurred at the trial regarding that. Lynn Walker being unequivocal about the fact she never agreed to transfer that 80 acres. There never was any agreement as far as compensating Eric Walker for his work through transfer of the land or by any other means. I think has to lead to the conclusion as a matter of law based on the very high standard that's applied, that there never was a contract sufficient to meet the requirements of Minnesota law as set forth in the Christie case. We also talk about the part performance exception to the statute of frauds. Again, I won't go through the facts on that, and it's a little bit repetitive with some of the evidence regarding whether there was an actual contract between the parties, an enforceable contract between the parties. But the part performance exception could not be applied, especially if the court had, in our view, ruled properly that Exhibit 3 and Exhibit 4 should not have been admitted into evidence. Let me turn to Exhibit 3. In this case, and the court, and you may have had a chance to read the dialogue that occurred at the trial regarding the admission of Exhibit 3. The court, with respect to post-trial motions, determined that Exhibit 3 was not hearsay in this case. And that is not accurate. The court relied on Rule 801 D1B, whether it was a prior consistent statement. And I think we've analyzed well the law in that area. And it's one thing for Eric Walker to come in and say, you know, on an annual basis, I would meet with both of my parents, and Lynn Walker denies this ever occurred. I would meet with both of my parents and they would sit down with me and we'd go over that year's billings. And then apparently Steve Walker would approve it. There's signatures from Steve Walker and the whole sequence of that. I think we've laid out in our briefing too, and whether or not that was truly what happened here. But to take that statement and then allow from that statement Eric Walker to put into evidence a whole bunch of financial information that is not tested under the hearsay rule is wrong. And we cite the court to the bootstrapping that can occur and the exception to what is hearsay. If you do that, there is no hearsay. You can always have a prior consistent statement used as a basis to put a whole bunch of otherwise inadmissible evidence into the record.
I believe that the district court had alternative bases for admitting Exhibit 3. That wasn't the only basis for admitting Exhibit 3. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I think the district court also determined that Exhibit 3 fell within the business record exception, and also if it did not, that it fell within the residual exception.
Right, and I'll start with the residual exception. The court made sort of a passing comment about that in its post-trial brief, and I'm not disparaging the court when I say that, just being factual. He did not go through the elements of the residual exception applying here, and considering all that's going on here, I frankly don't understand how you could apply the residual exception under these circumstances. The bills were transcribed from an undisclosed source. The bills were created long after Eric did the actual work. The bill's proponents, Steve and Eric, were caught in an attempt to recreate the originals and falsify them by backdating the signatures.
Mr. Schuller, though, I'm not sure I follow that last point, because
sure.
Exhibit 3 is the handwritten version of the same bills in Exhibit 4. So if the idea was to create some sort of false document, why admit Exhibit 3 along with Exhibit 4? Doesn't Exhibit 3 demonstrate the basis for the more formalized version of those bills in Exhibit 4?
Yeah, so take a look at my cross-examination of Eric and you'll see what happened. First, they tried to introduce Exhibit 4 at the deposition and said that was the basis for Eric's annual calculation of what he was owed. And by the way, it's summary. It's double hearsay. We haven't even gotten to the double hearsay argument in this case, which was also not addressed by the district court. So it's a summary of documents that were never produced to us in the case or offered at trial. So you have a double hearsay problem. Then Exhibit 4, they messed up Exhibit 4 because they claimed that was the document and that Steve Walker, in the years shown starting in 04, signed off on them each year. Steve Walker testified to that at his deposition. Eric Walker said, yeah, these were done in each year shown. 04 was done in 04, 05 was done in 05, et cetera. But the mistake that Eric Walker made is he put his current address on the document, showing that it couldn't have been created, that Exhibit 4 couldn't have been created in, say, 2007. Then after that happened, up pops Exhibit 3 magically, again, with no supporting documentation for Exhibit 3. And so they get the first bite at the apple since they're plaintiffs, and they did the right thing as a plaintiff. They got caught at the deposition in a lie about Exhibit 4. And by the way, Steve Walker recanted his testimony that he had signed Exhibit 4 in the individual year shown. And they did the smart thing as a trial lawyer, Mr. Braun did, and he said, well, I'm going to put in Exhibit 3 and I'm going to put in Exhibit 4 to at least indicate that, you know, we're fully on the up and up here with respect to these exhibits. That's what happened, which is additional evidence indicating that this whole thing is trumped up. And that's why I say applying the residual exception, the court should not have allowed it into evidence. or at least analyzed why the residual exception would apply. I don't know how you could do make that finding. With respect to the business record exception, like I say, it's not a business record because it's just a copy of other documents. The other documents would be the business record. It's not created at the time of the recorded events. This is allegedly a summary that occurs at the end of the year. And I submit to you, it was a summary that was created many years actually after the alleged work occurred.
Is it your position then that an invoice can never be a business record if it reflects work done over a period of time as opposed to, you know, 1 hour before it's prepared or a day before it's prepared?
No, an invoice can be a summary of other information. But when you look at this invoicing under the circumstances where this is being done, there is not an underlying basis for truthfulness to apply a hearsay exception or the business records exception. Again, if you could do it the way that they did it, you could put in all kinds of hearsay, all kinds of garbage can come into evidence under the guise of the business records exception. And it's not for the jury to decide whether that's fair or unfair or true or untrue. That's for the court to deal with as the gatekeeper to make sure we have a fair trial.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Shuler. Your time is up. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Thomas Braun. I also was trial counsel in this case, and I represent the respondent, Eric Walker. I want to first address the appellant's argument that the court erred in not granting judgment as a matter of law with respect to the claim for specific performance in this case. This argument was made to the trial court no less than three times. There was a summary judgment motion that was brought by the respondent. The court made detailed findings with respect to why the 80-acre claim should go to the jury. Counsel spent a lot of time in appellant's brief to the court talking about the court being a gatekeeper with respect to specific performance claims. And I think the court took that very seriously and dismissed one of the claims that was brought by Eric Walker with respect to the entire track. So the claim that was surviving was related to the 80 acres, and the court did a factual and very significant analysis each time this was argued to the court at summary judgment, at a motion for judgment as a matter of law, after the plaintiff rested its case, and then at the time of the motion for amended findings, all along rendering consistent decisions that what we have here is a very clear offer with respect to an oral contract. And frankly, who would expect less when we're talking about family farming deals? And this kind of reiterated throughout the case where we're talking about oral contracts between a child and his mom and dad, promises made essentially at the kitchen table. And if you look at the context of the case, you know, this didn't just happen in 2017 as appellant claims. And frankly, you know, that theory was argued to the jury and outright dismissed. You know, this has been a series of interactions and promises and a relationship that began really at Eric's birth, but started to materialize in 2001 when he graduated from high school and started to think about what his career was going to be. Eric made decisions, significant decisions, life-altering decisions based on the promises of his mother and father. So in 2004, when he started to farm the family farm after this incident related to an accident that happened when some livestock got loose, he started recording his time, his effort, his expenditures at the farm. And he did so, and he presented that information to his parents on an annual basis. You know, Exhibit 3 is an important set of documents. And frankly, you know, they were not subject to a motion in limine. You know, we ultimately took up this issue kind of on the fly. If appellant thought it was such a critical part of the case, I would have expected, you know, some level of argument about that particular exhibit at the inception. But I can tell you that there was significant cross-examination, and hearing counsel's comments to this court takes me back to the cross-examination and his closing argument to the jury as to why those documents shouldn't be believed. But to the contrary, the jury in fact found them to be very credible. And with respect to the judgment as a matter of law related to the specific performance, when you look at the entire picture and not just focus in on some of the minutia, it's very clear that the timing of the offer here to exchange the property for the debt occurred at the end of 2013.
What, Mr. Braun, can you address Mr. Schuller's argument that there isn't clear and convincing evidence that that Lynn agreed to the contract for the 80 acres?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I think that that starts with the Christie case and how we defined the clear and convincing jury instruction for the jury in this case. And frankly, we took appellant's language with respect to what clear and convincing meant and gave that to the jury. And then when you apply that standard to Ms. Walker's actions, okay, not just her words, now, counsel would have you believe that everyone's got to be in agreement here and say that an oral contract existed in order to clear the clear and convincing standard. You know, this is not a standard of beyond all doubt, which is essentially what they're trying to use the Christie case to stand for. It's clear and convincing evidence, and that was clearly defined based on the Christie standard. So if you look at what Lynn Walker did and didn't do over the course of time, I think it's very clear that her actions in 2013 showed that there was in fact an oral contract to convey that property. Eric Walker set up a camper on that 80 acres with his wife, got a building permit, and started construction of their home. They lived on that property until the home was constructed. Never one time during the construction of the home did Lynn Walker say, "Hey, son, stop building on my property. What are you doing?" Eric Walker's wife had Facebook postings where Eric Walker's sisters are seeing the construction taking place. Eric and Lynn Walker get married at the family farm and they're talking about moving in their home. Lynn Walker is not saying anything about, wait a minute, that's not your home, that's not your property. She took no action. So that inaction, I think, is evidence of the fact that she was in agreement initially of this oral contract to sever the property. I think also what's very important for the court to realize is that she did take some affirmative action as well. Eric was listed as an insured on the property and those documents were submitted into evidence in the case. They also, when I say they, I'm speaking about Eric's parents, Lynn and Steve Walker. They deeded 80 acres away from the family farm. They deeded it to themselves initially. That is some affirmative evidence that there was intent at that time on her part to give that 80 acres to Eric Walker. And ultimately she changed her mind and she changed it in 2017 when she decided that she wanted a divorce. And at that point in time, her motivation was very different because she was now motivated to obtain as much financial compensation as she could from this farm, despite the fact that her son invested $400,000 of his own money in this house, a house where his wife and her grandchildren resided. So the court, I think, very adequately addressed the judgment as a matter of law with respect to the specific performance. I want to talk about the statute of frauds issue and the part performance exception, because the appellant seems to initially make a big issue about this in its principal brief, and then somewhat backs away from it in the reply. But I think it's very, very clear that the exception that is applied here, the part performance exception, was not only found by the jury, it was recognized by the court. And frankly, there's substantial evidence to support the fact that there was part performance of this oral contract, which would remove this transaction from the statute of frauds. And again, you have to go back and look at the dealings of the parties. And really, this is where I think the appellant's argument is discredited the most and strongest, because she wants and wanted the jury to believe that this cabal started in 2017, but the actions of the parties date back to 2004. And everything that Eric Walker did, from living in that camper, building on the land, having no objection from Ms. Walker about that building of the property, and then moving into the finished home, She could have taken legal action at any point in time, or even sent him a letter or a text message or something. I mean, she acknowledged on the stand that she didn't object. And frankly, that's just not credible for someone who is having a nearly $500,000 home erected on their farm. If she really didn't intend that to be, she would have done something about it. The unequivocal reference theory, which is what this theory is kind of based on, really applies, we think, to these circumstances. And I think that as you look at the unequivocal reference theory, it speaks about equity. And that's exactly what the case is involving here, which is why the legislature created this exception to the statute of fraud. So someone in Eric Walker's position who has put in $375,000 of work to the farm, invested his own money in building that property, relied on the promise of his mother that this property would be his. He didn't need to have that deed in his hand in order to trust the fact that this property is going to be transferred. This was his mother. So why wouldn't he believe her? You know, little did he know that divorce was on the horizon, and a deed and legal obligation is something that he should have been concerned about. He was going off of what he believed were earnest and honest comments to honor past promises. So I want to talk, just finish my comments with respect to the evidentiary challenge that appellant is addressing in this matter. First, I think it's important to acknowledge the abuse of discretion standard that we're operating under here. The trial court has a lot of discretion with respect to evidentiary rulings. And even if there is an abuse of discretion, which we do not believe that there is, you have to show actual prejudice to the defendant in order to reverse on those decisions. And we don't believe that.
Wouldn't that be the case here if Exhibit 3 and 4 were not properly admitted because of the significance of the underlying bills to the determination that there was a contract for services?
I think the bills really corroborate his testimony that there were services, that that those amounts were given to his parents. I think the jury still could have very well found that those amounts and those obligations were relayed to his parents. You know, Steve Walker acknowledged that those obligations were due and owing. So even if you take the exhibits out, which we don't think you should, any admission we believe would be harmless error, because Eric Walker would still be permitted to testify about the services that he rendered, which he did, and the amounts that were due and owing. So,
well, let's turn to whether they were properly admitted, exhibits 3 and 4. Was exhibit 3 properly admitted as a business record, given that it was prepared, you know, once the bills were prepared once a year?
We believe absolutely.
He argues that the bills weren't prepared close enough in time to when the work was done, as I understand his argument, and therefore the bills don't fall within the business record exception. Argument anyway.
Sure, and thank you, Your Honor. That speaks to really prong two of 803.6, and we could quibble about the timeliness, I guess, of the creation of the bill. Eric said that he did them annually. It's an accruing balance that he presented at the end of the year. I know of no case which says that the bill must be created at that moment. There's discretion here in the trial court to determine the timing of and when the record was created near the event. And the court weighed the timeliness of the creation of those bills. You can see that in the court's amended findings order, and deemed these bills to be created in a timely fashion. You know, farming enterprises, there's a lot of work that's done at the end of the year. The harvesting, the taking the grain to market, the drying. So it's only logical that these bills would be presented in the fashion that they were, and they were done in a contemporaneous manner. So we believe that 803.6 certainly applied then. We believe it was within the court's discretion to allow those bills to be submitted under that exception to the hearsay rule. But 801D1B also applies. And clearly Eric Walker testified. The statements are consistent with his testimony, and as the court determined in its findings of fact, those statements were helpful to the jury. And I hope that the court doesn't get distracted between the Exhibit 3 and Exhibit 4 distinction, because it's not really much of a distinction at all. Eric Walker testified about this at trial, and clearly the jury determined that his testimony was credible. The court determined that his testimony was credible. And Exhibit 4 is non-hearsay, and they were offered to provide an explanation with respect to the timing and the construction of these invoices. And you know, finally, I think 807 also is certainly in play here. I don't think you have to go there because clearly the business records exception is met. But when you look at the rules of 807, whether a statement is offered as material fact and more probative than any other in the interest of justice would be served by admitting the evidence, all three of those prongs are met in this case. We're talking about significant services that Eric Walker rendered to this family over years. And the uncontradicted testimony at trial is that he was never really paid for what he did. So, you know, that really discredits any argument that this is a cabal established in 2007, that this is a relationship that was longstanding. The jury worked really hard for 2 weeks on this case, and we ask that this court affirm its verdict and the trial court's determinations with respect to both pre and post verdict motions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shuler, you now have 5 minutes for rebuttal argument.
Thank you. Going back to the business records exception to the hearsay rule, I'll start with the last requirement, which is whether or not the record that's produced or provided is trustworthy or lacks trustworthiness. You know, just a few examples here. The 2017 invoice that made up part of Exhibit 3 was created by Steve, the husband's attorney's office. That wasn't created by Eric Walker. But it was included in the summary that he provided. No one is addressing, including the district court so far, the double hearsay that's involved. This is based on other records which they admitted they had, but never produced to us. So I don't even know that you would get to the business records exception until you can get past the fact that the summary is double hearsay. I've already gone through the fact that Exhibit 3 is based on backdated signatures and that there was testimony, conflicting testimony as to when those signatures, under oath, as to when those signatures actually took place. And Eric's replication of stuff scratched out on undisclosed source materials is not a trustworthy business practice. So it would be difficult to find that the third prong of the business records exception would apply. I've already talked about the fact that it was not prepared at the time of the recorded events. And actually, the record is all over the map as to when Exhibit 4, especially, but also Exhibit 3, was actually prepared in this case. And then I've also, I think, made some mention of the fact he had no duty to copy the source materials accurately. And there was no evidence regarding that. So there wasn't foundation established for that business records exception to apply to the hearsay that's involved here. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is counsel was addressing basically the level of proof that's required in order for contract formation to occur such that an oral contract to convey real estate could potentially be enforced, or at least you'd create a jury question. And the Supreme Court, and we cite the court to this, said in the, I'll call it Goulet case at 86 Northwest at 780, quote, "We doubt if a case can be found where the testimony of an interested party has alone been held sufficient," unquote, "in a case where the clear and convincing standard applied." So we clearly don't have the standard that the Goulet court applied, which is because Lynn Walker contested this ever was done. We don't have any deed. There's no writing whatsoever indicating any agreement with respect to the 80 acres. And I have to make, counsel got into a kind of an evidentiary argument here. I should talk about prejudice, by the way, with respect to Exhibits 3 and 4. That was a critical part of the case, as I've already mentioned. And get to my right notes here, sorry. They formed the basis for Eric's labor claim. It was the linchpin to the claim that he should get the 80 acres. Without exhibits 3 or 4, there's no basis in the case to award damages, to find that a contract exists, or to find that part performance occurred. So the admission of those two exhibits was absolutely critical to the case. And as far as these additional evidentiary arguments that take place, the best evidence that there wasn't an agreement to transfer the 80 acres is Lynn Walker's testimony that she refused to sign a deed to transferring the 80 acres away from herself. And this occurs back, I believe, it's been a while since I tried the case and there are a lot of facts here, but I think that's 13 or 14, just at about roughly the time when construction starts on the house. And this whole assertion that Eric Walker paid for this himself, that gets back to the cash can argument, and that there literally would have to be hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Schiller, can I ask you a
sure
question about part performance? And I know your time is limited. You rely on the Shaughnessy case, which is a 1946 Supreme Court case. Respondent relies on the Burke case, which is a 1952 Supreme Court case. It seems to me that the Burke case is really controlling, and that case allows for part performance where there is reliance, acts of in reliance on a contract that have so altered an individual's position that it would work in an injustice not to apply that, or it would work in injustice to apply the statute of fraud. So doesn't that language in Burke apply in this case?
No, it doesn't, because first, of course, you'd have to have a proper contract formation. You'd have to meet the Christie standard for the establishment
assuming
agreement.
There is a proper contract, assuming we conclude that there isn't a basis to overturn the district court's decision on that.
Well, obviously, we do feel the Shaughnessy case is controlling here, and I know you've looked at Burke.
But it predates the Burke case. That's where I'm confused, why you would rely on that versus Burke.
I'm not aware of the Burke case overruling Shaughnessy, or that Shaughnessy is not good law in Minnesota. It does state in Shaughnessy that the construction of the house in this particular case, or if applying Shaughnessy in this case, the construction of the house would have had to have been unequivocally referable to a vendor-vendee relationship. And obviously there's great equivocation here.
But in Burke, the court recognizes two alternative grounds for finding part performance, and I guess, and Shaughnessy doesn't, and that's what I'm trying to drive at, is the fact that you're not recognizing the second ground, and I'm wondering why that is.
And I'm sorry, the second ground that you're referring to?
Is where there's acts that are done in reliance on the contract such that it would work an injustice to apply the statute of frauds.
Yeah, well, if that were the only standard that applied toward for part performance, again, that exception, I think, would wipe out the rule. There has to be certainty as to the existence of an actual agreement and that there truly was part performance. And that gets back to exhibits 3 and 4 and whether they should be admitted, whether there ever was really an agreement to begin with, and whether or not you actually have the evidence to establish that you truly did rely on this. And that standard is not met in this case. So based on that, we request that you find that there was no contract to convey the 80 acres and remand for a new trial regarding the income loss claim.
Thank you to the attorneys for the arguments, the answers to our questions, and your briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the hearing.
Thank you.